This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and here we are, once again, gathered together for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions come to us via radio program at AOL.com. It's an opportunity to send questions of a medical or nutritional nature to us, and we'll field them. And we're pleased to say that you just keep sending the questions, and a lot of them are really good grist from the mill for our weekly Q&A. With me, Layla Mutin is a registered dietitian. She has a master's degree in the field of nutrition, licensed to practice nutrition in the state of New York, and we work together at our practice in Manhattan and collaborate on intelligent medicine. How are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very well, thanks. And so we're going to get to questions in just a minute, but before we do that, interesting headline this week, actually a series of headlines. I'm reading, study finds pasta can help you lose weight. Here's another one. Eating pasta linked to weight loss.
Don't we wish?
Pasta promotes weight loss as part of a low glycemic index diet. And here's another one. Can eating pasta really help you lose weight? So this is kind of a, you know, a popular headline, this week. And so we're going to turn to our resident nutritionist to break that down for us. Can we really, put on the feed bag for pasta and just effortlessly lose weight? What does the study say?
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah, because I got to say, I got a weak spot for pasta. I do have pasta occasionally.
I have pasta occasionally.
I went to an Italian restaurant with a good colleague. Actually, he's been a guest on Intelligent Medicine, Dr. Dennis Goodman. And they have a gluten-free pasta offering. So I had a one of these a seafood pasta. And so there's all this like wonderful, you know, seafood in it. And I asked for the gluten-free version of that, and it was really delicious. Hit the spot. But, I have to admit that had I been home and there had been pasta, you know, sitting on the stove, I would have gone for seconds, thirds, and fourths because I just find it's so addictive. It is. It's great.
You know, because an hour later you're hungry again.
So, so what's the story? I mean, can we really effortlessly lose weight, with pasta? What does the study say?
I wish, but you know, there's really no conclusion here, as I'm going to tell you now. Researchers at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, they based their findings on a meta-analysis of available evidence from previous randomized controlled trials. Okay?
So this is not new. This is just a compendium of previously done studies.
Yeah. Yeah. So although systematic reviews, meta-analyses of RCTs of dietary patterns include these foods, but they are low on the glycemic index, meaning high in whole grains, dietary fiber, have shown advantages for weight-related outcomes. But there's been a general lack of recognition of the importance of carbohydrate quality. So what they did, the researchers examined 32 randomized controlled trials, RCTs, involving about 2,400 participants who ate pasta instead of other carbohydrates in a healthy low glycemic diet. Now, the median age of these subjects was 50 years old with a body mass index of 30.4, a BMI of 30.
So that's a little heavy. You can imagine these people were heavy and probably insulin resistant.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yes. So in 21 trials, they included participants who were overweight and obese. So what the subjects did, they had an average of 3.3 servings of cooked pasta per week. That's about
I could do that in like one sitting, 3.3 servings.
You can, because a serving of pasta, if you really measure it out, and people are measuring before they cook, No. After you've cooked your spaghetti or your penne, measure out a half cup. Yes, that's right. That's a serving.
A half cup?
So they ate,
Are you serious?
3.3 servings of pasta per week instead of other carbs.
No, you know, so, I mean, there's some problems with that.
You
know, first of all, you know, this was what's called risk mitigation. In other words, they substituted the pasta for stuff that was worse, right? So pasta is better than, I don't know, you know.
A donut.
Yeah, right.
And you know, a bucket of flan.
Yep, exactly.
Some cake.
Yeah. So so it's a step up.
Yeah.
But it's not the answer for people who are insulin resistant. You know, I just recently recorded, today, in fact, I recorded a podcast with, there was 6 hours time difference because he's in South Africa, Dr. Tim Noakes, and he's an LCHF advocate, low carb, high fat advocate. And you'll hear that podcast when it's produced, you know, probably around the time this one comes out, in the second week of April. And, he actually started out as a carbo-loading exercise physiologist, recommended a low-fat, high-carb diet. Then he developed type 2 diabetes. And somehow he got a hold of an article about the low-carb, high-fat diet. And he was incensed and angry, and he read it at first to debunk it. But then, you know, started to sink in. He said, I got to try this. And he tried it. And ultimately, he beat his diabetes. He only eats about 10% calories from carbs, and he exercises a lot. But he also became the object of an inquisition. It literally was a trial of the century from a nutritional standpoint in South Africa. He ultimately prevailed, but the powers that be really wanted to shut him down because it was heresy. This was heretical.
Heresy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
you know, Galileo heretical. And Copernicus, you know, in the you know, in the Middle Ages, you know, kind of thing.
So of this trial, at the end of this trial, Dr. Hoppen, what they found is over 12 weeks, they looked at these participants, over 12 weeks, they lost about a pound.
Hey, wait a minute. Do you think we could stay in business at our practice in New York by offering patients a 12-week diet program in which they lose a pound?
Yeah.
I would say that's no result at all. Right. I mean, people would be incensed. They'd say, what am I paying good money for to see you guys, you know, to tell me about a diet where I can lose a pound in 12 weeks?
But what I'm really incensed by is that the lead author in the study, and I'm quoting him, quote, the study found that pasta didn't contribute to weight gain or increase body fat.
Right.
Okay. In fact, analysis actually showed a small weight loss. So contrary to concerns, perhaps pasta can be part of a healthy diet. Yeah. As on a low glycemic index diet. And the researchers also cautioned that pasta was consumed along with other low glycemic index foods. This is no result. This is what you said. It's risk reduction.
Right.
So, you know, don't eat the donut. Don't eat whatever, but eat the pasta instead and let's see what happens. So, right.
Yeah. Also, something interesting. They say here that the meta-analysis wasn't funded by the pasta industry. Okay, well, that's good. So far, so good. Right.
So Barilla didn't take...
However, some of the authors previously received research grants, in-kind donations of pasta for studies, and travel support from the pasta maker Barilla.
I knew Barilla had to be in there somewhere. So, okay.
Could you please send me to Florence, Naples, or Rome so I can do some research? I really would like that. Thank you very much. And I'll write you a nice paper about the benefits of pasta and ravioli and whatever. I mean, obviously, we are a case in point because it's not like we completely eschew pasta forever. We've sworn off. I mean, under certain occasions, we might have it. I think I probably would have it, you know, less than, you know, I pulled up 10 fingers, less than that number of times per year, for sure. Maybe less than five. And it's fun, you know, because, you know, when you're on a good diet and you have something a little different.
It's a novelty.
It's novelty. It's wonderful. I mean, like, you know, I had matzah for Passover. You know, I'm on a paleo diet. It's a grain. But hey, you know, it's Passover, so you do that, okay?
Yeah.
And then you get back on the horse and ride and, you know, follow your clean diet. But, you know, I got to say that, you know, maybe this is something that could be good for people who have a BMI of like 28 or 27, you know, like they're a little borderline, a little, maybe they got a few pounds to lose. That could work for them. But, you know, for people who are type 2 diabetics, they're going to need medication to get them to normal blood sugar unless they get on a really low carb diet.
That's true. That's true. So even the participants in the study, if any of them were diabetic, they would require the use of possibly insulin.
Yeah.
You know, to help undo the damage of the pasta. Yeah.
Certainly oral hypoglycemics. Okay, so much for that. And you know, again, the problem with these, I don't have a big problem with the study, and the study is, you know, if you'd really follow it and do it in a spirit of moderation, fine. But I think what that does is it kind of opens the doors to people who say, oh, yeah, you know, I just read an article, you know, it's like a water cooler talk in the office. I just read an article saying that you can eat pasta and lose weight. Okay, so let's go for some pasta. You know, let's go to, you know, what's the Italian restaurant chain there? Whatever.
Olive Garden.
We're going to go there. Right. Right.
Yeah. All right. Well, should we move on to questions?
Yes.
Okay. We've got an email from Remo. Dear Dr. Hoffman, my wife of 57 years old had a recent very painful experience that resulted in a visit to our family doctor. X-rays and ultrasound revealed gallstones, and the physician recommended her to see a surgeon and have the gallbladder removed. I'm writing to you to see if there are any alternatives to surgery.
Sure. Well, you know,
our family doctor has yet to discuss any options or alternatives with her. I've seen your article online and I found it very informative, and I really don't know where else to go with this. My wife is very uncomfortable with surgery and having her gallbladder removed.
So here's the deal. There are, you know, as I describe in the article, there are criteria for surgery. If you are a diabetic, the presence of gallstones usually indicates a need for surgery because people with diabetes have worse outcomes when they have severe gallbladder attacks. Partly is because they lack the ability to sense visceral pain because of nerve damage, and part of it is also just diabetics in general. Are not the greatest subject for surgery. It can be a little dicier because of blood sugar control. So they, you know, you find gallstones in diabetic, they say, well, look, this, you know, when you're still healthy, get it done. The other thing is about the size of the stones. Very large stones sometimes require surgery. And the other is if you just have frequent attacks, you know, it's debilitating, have the surgery. Because these days, the surgery is less of a big deal than it was in the old days when they had a big, you know, carve a big scar across your abdomen, and
they're doing it laparoscopically.
Laparoscopic keyhole surgery, in essence, and it's like you can in the hospital for, you know, a day or two, and boom. However, just the presence of gallstones does not necessarily necessitate surgery. So it's a judgment call. I can't tell you in this instance without knowing more information if I would recommend surgery, because I often am called upon to do a second opinion for some patients. For some patients, someone who travels a lot to countries where, you know, it just is, they would not like to be hospitalized for gallbladder, maybe it's a good idea to get your stones removed. Depends a little on your lifestyle. But there are procedures and diets that actually help you reduce your susceptibility to attacks. And some people go happily to their grave in 105 with gallstones. So that's not just the mere presence of gallstones doesn't necessitate surgery. These days, it's just done casually because that's the way we do things in America.
Right. Dr. Hoffman, just I have a question about this. Could you do a lithotripsy?
Well, lithotripsy is one of the treatments that has been researched. It doesn't work too well. For it works for renal stones, but it doesn't work too well for gallbladder stones. Okay. So there's also you know, infusions of certain medications that dissolve the stones. They don't work too well. Actigal and things like that. They only work for certain types of stones. Stones that are primarily cholesterol, they can help dissolve. But if they're if there's bile mixed in with cholesterol, and the stones are what are called radiolucent, they show up on an X-ray, it's harder to dissolve the stones. You know, there's this procedure of the liver gallbladder flush. I think they make too much out of that. I really don't think that.
Isn't that debunked?
It is. It's been debunked, but you know, things that have been debunked by medical journal articles, they'll often say, "Well, that's what those orthodox doctors say." They don't, you know. Of course, if it's in a medical journal, it can't be right because they're biased. But I have to say that the research doesn't suggest that what's coming out when you do a liver gallbladder flush are real stones. They're just sort of like globs of olive oil.
Of olive oil.
Which look like green, and they look like stones, but they're just, when they are analyzed, they're not stones. So, things that are helpful, coffee consumption is actually helpful.
Yes.
It turns out that a very low fat diet is actually not that helpful. You know, if you go on it like a real weight loss bender, you know, 500 calories, very low fat, you're more likely to get gallstones. On the other hand, go ahead.
And there's a little irony about how gallstones may develop and then the diet treatment. It's really the opposite. If you've been on a very, very low fat, no fat diet for many years, this is actually a risk factor for producing gallstones. But then once you have those gallstones,
you become fat intolerant.
You have to go low fat because otherwise your gallbladder is going to contract, causing you the pain.
Yes. And that's why many people with gallstones are fat intolerant. So, however, there is what's called a Brenneman diet, which is an old concept. Came out in the early 60s, I think, 65. Dr. John Brenneman, who is an allergist, wrote that in a small series of patients that he followed, they could almost completely avoid gallbladder attacks, although they had gallstones, by avoiding certain key foods. And among the biggest culprits were, I believe, pork, eggs, dairy. Soy was among the foods. I don't have the complete list, but if you look up the Brenneman diet, it's worth a try if you want to see if you can tame your gallstones and make them and become asymptomatic. Also, omega-3 fatty acids have been shown to help prevent them. Maybe will help to prevent them from getting worse. So there's a solution that's popular in Europe called Roacol that helps a little bit with gallstones, but once they're past a certain size and consistency, it doesn't really dissolve the gallstones. And I actually, if you look up a series of articles, I think it's a three-part series, if you look up, you know, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, gallstones, you can, you know, have a discussion with footnotes and links to other articles that talk about gallbladder disease for a more complete discussion.
It's a pretty common surgery.
Yeah.
And the thing is, sometimes what can happen afterwards, just so Remo can let his wife know, is that sometimes there's some diarrhea in the weeks post-surgery.
We just saw a patient like that, by the way. It was a young woman who had a gallbladder, her gallbladder removed, and she was not making bile. We actually saw that her scores in her stool test showed that she was insufficient bile. So we gave her bile with pancreatic ox bile with pancreatic enzymes to help her break down her fat.
Yeah. So Remo, I guess then surgery would be, and it's not a big to-do. They're doing it laparoscopically. The outcomes are generally just fine with some residual diarrhea after the surgery.
It may take a while to acclimate. Yeah.
Exactly, because the liver is now freely secreting that bile with no more depot to store it in, which was the gallbladder, which is hence gone.
So it's a matter of the timing of the secretion, because when you have an intact gallbladder, you secrete bile in response to a meal. When mm-hmm. you don't have a gallbladder, there's no reservoir for the bile. And so you're continuously secreting bile. So your threshold for fat may be lower. Maybe lower.
Exactly. Especially yeah. in the beginning, and you work up a kind mm-hmm. of tolerance to
yep.
it.
Yep.
Okay. Remo, thank you for your question. Best of luck to your wife.
Yeah.
Okay. We have a question from Mickey. Mickey writes, "Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla, my most trusted medical source." Thank you, Mickey.
Wow, that's a high accolade, yeah. you know, given we've got
that,
the American
really
Medical
is,
Association,
yeah.
the American Heart Association. Don't trust those guys. I'd go directly to Intelligent Medicine for advice. Okay.
There you go. So Mickey says, "My 76-year-old husband has been treated since his late 50s with Proscar and Flomax for BPH, mm-hmm. benign prostatic."
Can we explain what those are for just a minute?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a dual-action approach to an enlarged prostate. First of all, Proscar shrinks the prostate, okay? It actually blocks the so-called bad testosterone. And that's one of the reasons why finasteride which is the generic name for Proscar, has also been used to block hair loss because it blocks the bad testosterone that may promote hair loss. So that's one thing. It does shrink the prostate. In fact, I have to say just a little anecdote. I actually sat next to the inventor of Proscar, who was a surprisingly young woman who was at my medical school. I went to a dinner at my medical school, and I was seated next to the inventor of Proscar. Very cool.
Wow. Albert yeah. Einstein Medical
yeah,
School?
At Einstein Medical School. So the other medication is, was it Flomax? What is it
Flomax,
called?
Yeah.
Flomax, yeah. Flomax works on the nerves. So it will reduce the sense of urgency, but it also may have other side effects. It may cause dry mouth for patients who are maybe having mild cognitive impairment or on the verge of dementia. It may have cognitive effects. It can be constipating.
Yes.
So
anything that causes dry mouth is going to be constipating.
Yeah, it works
to
on
some
the
degree.
It works on the
yeah.
autonomic nervous system. So it targets supposedly the urinary tract, but it also will have other ancillary effects. Okay.
So Mickey says that diagnosed with a UTI, a urinary tract infection, he was successfully treated with antibiotics. Although on repeated testing his PSA is low, he still experiences chronic urinary urgency. He gets up at least twice a night during the night. Could this be a symptom of the UTI or some other condition? Now, he's 76.
Yeah, it could be that he has a low-grade UTI, although I think she mentioned that the urinary the urinalyses are and cultures are negative, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. She doesn't really mention okay. he was diagnosed with a UTI and treated successfully.
So sometimes the first, you
with
know,
antibiotics,
sometimes
yeah.
there's a chronic UTI when the flow is not good because there's yeah. retention of urine in the bladder. So it could be a chronic low-grade UTI. But of course, it's kind of a mixed bag because he has frequent urination due to an enlarged prostate.
Yeah.
And so it's
with a low PSA.
With a low PSA, which is reassuring.
Is low, which is
yeah.
good.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. I mean, haven't we found that some people really respond to a diet in terms of urinary urgency? What would we tell people to avoid?
Sometimes spicy foods, certain fruits
alcohol,
like citrus.
Coffee.
I'll tell you one thing. Urinary urgency, for anybody who's drinking coffee mm-hmm. and has urinary urgency, the mm-hmm. first thing I eliminate is the coffee.
And even decaf. Yep.
And even decaf, and I have seen this be life-changing
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
for some of our patients. Like, yeah. oh, no yeah. more, gotta yeah. go right now.
Yeah.
It's gone. Yeah.
Yeah, I got to say, you know, I had a three-hour car ride, and I didn't want to stop. So I made sure that I didn't drink a lot of coffee. And I did just fine, you know, so... you know, I think it's just a good policy unless you're at home.
Right.
Or maybe, you know, at night, maybe not to drink a lot of, certainly coffee can keep you up, but even decaf can cause you to have nocturia, which is frequent
yes.
wake-ups to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
So it's...
I also tell our patients not to drink so much water after, you know, so much after dinner, of course, be ruled by your thirst.
Mm-hmm.
And if there are certain medications or certain supplements you're taking at night, of course, mm-hmm. you must. But yeah,
Dr. Hoffman and Layla told me to take those supplements at bedtime, and I should yeah. drink a full glass of water.
Right.
There are certain things we tell people to take yeah. at bedtime, you know, like strontium, for example.
Strontium, yeah. mm-hmm. yes. Or probiotics.
Or melatonin or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some sleep aids, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people, if they're out and about all day long, they drink less because they don't want to have to be looking for a bathroom.
Yeah.
So they save it all for the end of the day. Mm-hmm. You don't want to do that either.
Yeah.
You want to sip water all day long.
Yeah, I think a lot of women are chronically dehydrated for that precise reason, because bathrooms are kind yeah. of unsanitary and scary, and you know, they just, you know, so they dehydrate themselves, and that's not mm-hmm. good. That's not good.
Yeah. No.
All right. So all right. let's pause, because we divide these podcasts into two parts, and give us a preview of what we're going to be tackling in part two.
Oh, this is good. Why do so many nutraceuticals take so long to start working compared with pharmaceutical right. drugs?
We want fast relief.
Right now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today with Layla Mutin. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, and we'll be right back with more questions in part two.